I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Billionaire businessman Jeffrey Epstein was arrested in New York Saturday on federal charges related to sex trafficking. The 66-year-old hedge fund manager has long been accused of sexually abusing underage girls. In 2007, he pleaded guilty to two prostitution counts in Florida as part of a controversial deal to avoid federal charges. He was sentenced to 13 months in jail. Former Miami U.S. Attorney Alexander Acosta handled that deal. Acosta is now Secretary of the U.S. Labor Department. In February, the White House said it was looking into the handling of that case, and a federal judge is weighing whether to invalidate the agreement.
Tonight, there is another vacancy in the president's cabinet. Labor Secretary Alex Acosta says he will now resign because of the controversy surrounding the plea deal he worked out with Jeffrey Epstein 11 years ago when Acosta was a federal prosecutor.
Epstein once counted President Trump and former President Clinton among his friends. He has a bond hearing scheduled for Monday.
Jeffrey Epstein will remain in jail while he awaits trial on sex trafficking charges. A federal judge in New York has denied bail for the wealthy financier. The 66-year-old is accused of sexually abusing dozens of girls, some as young as 14 years old.
Did you ever see Mr. Epstein with underage girls?
No. Oh, no. If I had ever seen Jeffrey Epstein in any inappropriate situation with an underage girl, I would have terminated my relationship and turned him in.
Clinton's office now saying he knows nothing about the terrible crimes and that in 2002 and 2003, President Clinton took a total of four trips on Jeffrey Epstein's airplane and that he's not spoken to Epstein in well over a decade. Today, President Trump pressed to answer questions about Epstein.
He was a fixture in Palm Beach. I had a falling out with him a long time ago. I don't think I've spoken to him for 15 years. I wasn't a fan. I was not, a long time ago, I'd say maybe 15 years. I was not a fan of his, that I can tell you.
On this, the return edition of Parallax Views, independent journalist Pierce Redmond of Porkins Policy Review joins us once again to discuss updates in the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein. The billionaire registered sex offender with associates in the highest positions of wealth and power. Pierce previously joined Parallax Views for a special two-part deep dive into the dirty details of the Epstein case in September of 2018. Fast forward to July of 2019. Jeffrey Epstein has been arrested on federal charges of sex trafficking, and the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein has broken fully into the mainstream consciousness. A quick note before we dive into the conversation with Pierce. This episode was recorded over the weekend, prior to the news that broke today about Jeffrey Epstein being found injured in his jail cell from a possible suicide attempt. Other than that recent major development, this episode is up to date. And now, without further ado, my conversation with Pierce Redmond on the continuing sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Pierce Redmond of Porkin's Policy Review. It's been a crazy month. We've both been taking a break from podcasting right in the middle of this big news. Jeff Epstein has been arrested, and now he's not even going to get bail, I guess. The judge has decided, you know, he's not setting bail for him.
Yes, that is correct. And yeah, we've both been on a bit of a summer vacation, and of course, the minute, you know, you just try to relax, you've got this breaking news and everything. I was glad that the Epstein stuff broke after I had moved apartments, at least. But it was, you know, it was kind of like, I guess, no rest for the weary. I did take a bit of a break this past week, so I'm kind of catching up on some of the more recent developments. So bear with me if I'm not as up to date on everything, because now, of course, we were talking about this before we went on the air. Everybody and their mother is writing about Epstein. So there's like a new article every day. But yes, you are correct, JG. His bail has been denied. So he will be basically remanded, I believe, to the Metropolitan Correction Center, which is a very, extreme like a lockdown facility in Lower Manhattan. That's where some of the worst criminals are held. I think he will be probably, you know, on like a 23-hour lockdown, and you know, his only visitors will be his attorneys.
Yeah, the judge was saying, you know, he will abuse again if we let him out. Like, the judge seemed really like adamant about, you know, sort of teaching him a lesson this time.
Yes, the judge in this case does seem to be, I don't want to like jinx it or, you know, or anything like that. But and I don't think he's like an activist judge, but he does seem to be much more sympathetic to the victims. The judge in question is also whose name is escaping me, Richard Berman. I believe is the judge. He is also like a social worker. He has some sort of award recently for his work as a social worker and his social work. And he was also, you know, he does seem to kind of have a thing about the super wealthy being able to kind of rewrite the rules, so to speak, when it comes to jail time and bail and whatnot. He is kind of famous for recently denying bail of a Turkish-Iranian individual who his name is escaping me. I'll try to look it up, but he is tangentially connected to Michael Flynn and some of those investigations. But anyway, this individual is extremely wealthy. He wanted to do a similar thing to what Epstein's attorneys proposed, where he would be basically under house arrest in his, you know, giant penthouse somewhere, where he would hire private security to make sure that he didn't flee. And Judge Berman basically denied this and said that, you know, that the rich can't make up rules. And just because he can afford to do this, you know, what about everybody that can't afford a $500 bail? What happens to them? So, it does. The judge in this case does seem to be, I think, you know, he's probably leaning a bit more towards the victims, although it's very early in the case, obviously. And furthermore, Judge Berman also seems to be very well read about this case. So if you follow the proceedings just a few days ago, when during the latest bail hearing, which was eventually, went against Epstein, he seemed to be very up to date with all of the media reports that had been out there. So, you know, he's definitely keeping abreast of what's going on. He, you know, cited everything from the Miami Herald to the New York Post, articles written about Epstein, questioning the you know, his attorney's assertions that Epstein wasn't a flight risk, basically.
Well, his attorneys are also, I think I read that they were almost saying this is almost like a double jeopardy thing. Like they're trying to go after the him for the same things, you know, that he I guess the first case was in Florida, right?
Yes,
this one's
in
New York.
Yes. And, you know, the indictment itself is somewhat vague. There does seem to be some overlap between the current federal indictment in the Southern District of New York and the case which took place in the Southern District of Florida. So there are references to victims in Palm Beach in this current indictment. There are assertions put out by Epstein's attorneys that some of these victims are the same. You know, that they were victims from back in Palm Beach. I don't know if that is accurate. It could be accurate that there are some of the women that have come forward accusing Epstein this currently might have been questioned in the past. But the case which took place down in Palm Beach was extremely limited. And there were only a few victims that actually that did come forward to allege, you know, being molested or raped by Epstein at the time. So it's possible that there were a lot of girls that were interviewed by the Palm Beach PD. So it is possible that some of those people are involved in this one. I think it's also likely that these are new victims as well. Certainly there are more people coming forward filing civil suits against Epstein, you know, as we speak right now.
What sort of led to the arrest? What led to the DA finally jumping on him in New York?
That's a good question. I don't know if there's really like one solid answer to that.
Gun, right?
Yeah, there. I don't think so. Obviously, you can go online and you can get some opinions on that. You know, good buddy Mike Cernovich believes that he is the sole reason for why this indictment is happening. That is obviously bullshit. You can just sort of on face value, nothing in the lawsuit to which Cernovich is an intervener is not even like the original. You know, it's not like he filed this suit originally. He's an intervener. Is in the Second Circuit here in New York City. There are going to be something in the neighborhood of 2,000 pages that are going to be released, that were under seal, that are going to be released, relating to a defamation suit between Guffrey, I think that's how you pronounce her name. I've heard so many different pronunciations since the news.
This Virginia is Virginia Roberts. The yes. One that has mentioned Prince Andrew amongst many others. Yeah.
Right. So in a defamation suit between her and I believe it's Ghislaine Maxwell, not Ghislaine Maxwell, but between the two of them, there are going to be a lot of documents unsealed. Now, Cernovich, if you ask him, he is the reason that this indictment is happening in the Southern District, because these things are about to be unsealed. Therefore, this is pushing them to go after Epstein. This is just, again, on face value, is BS, because nothing has been unsealed. We don't know what's in these documents, number one. Number two, there are going to be redactions even within that. And number three, I had a guest on the show recently, freelance journalist Marlon Ettinger, who I think you know as well, JG.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Marlon actually was down at the courthouse when this was all happening. He actually confronted Mike Cernovich, who, you know, basically just didn't want to answer any of Marlon's questions about his connections to Alan Dershowitz. And then, you know, went on Periscope to call Marlon, some sort of like an agent of Epstein's or something. But Marlon also asked both David Boies and Brad Edwards, two attorneys intimately involved in these particular lawsuits, and particularly with Virginia Guthrie. So they both stated that the unsealing of these documents has nothing to do with the current case that we're seeing. And they said, furthermore, I mean, there's just, how could they, when we don't know what's in, you know, what's going to be unsealed. And also, again, and this is, you know, Mike Cernovich, right, the great legal mind of our generation. He's always quick to talk about how he's a lawyer. Well, I would assume that as a lawyer, Mike would know, you know, that a federal investigation involving the NYPD, the FBI, and the Southern District of New York, this would be, they would at least have to have been working on this a month or two before the indictment, you know, before the actual arrest. So how did they know necessarily that, you know, these documents are going to be released and therefore we need to arrest Epstein? Also, quickly on this, what Cernovich, Dershowitz, and the Miami Herald are doing in that lawsuit is not necessarily pertinent to the current federal indictment. Now, we don't know who the victims are in the federal indictment. We don't know what, you know, they're asking for. You know, we're not sure exactly were these crimes happening in Palm Beach, in New York? Was Virginia Roberts present? You know, we don't know any of those sort of things. So, and again, we're talking about a defamation suit between two individuals that are, of course, you know, connected to this federal indictment in the sense that Maxwell was obviously Epstein's, you know, right-hand person, and Guthrie was one of his sex slaves, for lack of a better term. But, you know, I don't really know how he's jumping to that conclusion that they're necessarily related. These are two separate cases. But again, this is very much in the vein of Mike Cernovich taking credit for things that other people have done. And I believe that what Cernovich is doing is, you know, he is taking a page out of the book of one of his friends and maybe mentors, Alan Dershowitz. And Dershowitz has been, if you've been following him on Twitter, he has been trying to spin a narrative that with the unsealing of these documents, particularly summary judgment of Maxwell, and also emails and conversations that Guthrie had with various people, he believes that this will completely exonerate him. Now, it is possible that I'm sure that there are going to be things unsealed that we're going to see that does not paint Virginia Guthrie in a positive light. There might even be instances where, you know, she gets facts wrong. She misrepresents certain things. That's possible.
Could I cut in real quick?
Sure.
I was going to say, too, I know there were some of the victims, and I forget the specific one that I read about. One of the victims also helped with recruiting at one point, and now she's not commenting on anything. So do you think that could be happening with Guthrie, or is this different?
Oh, it could be. I mean, that as far as I know, that's never been alleged by anybody involved in these, and I don't know. My gut is that if that were the case, it probably would have come out already, because that would, of course, taint. From what I gather, reading Dershowitz tweets, also listening to there's some audio which I posted on the episode I did with Marlon. People can go and check out. There's audio from oral arguments from Guthrie's lawyers, I think it's Paul Casal, Mark Randazza, Cernovich's attorney, and also attorneys for Dershowitz, where they're arguing their case in front of the, you know, the Second Court. One of the things that, that Dershowitz lawyers bring up is some sort of a manuscript that Guffrey was working on with somebody where she, I guess, admits that she didn't sleep with Dershowitz or something like that. And I believe that there's also conversations between or emails back and forth between Guffrey and a journalist who is helping her with the manuscript. Dershowitz believes that this will exonerate him. It's important to note that Guffrey's lawyers are totally fine with everything being unsealed. No one's arguing to stop the unsealing at this point. So there must be plenty of evidence in these documents that will make Dershowitz look guilty of sin, that they will have him dead to rights. So what Dershowitz is doing is he is just trying to get ahead of this story, which is what he's always tried to do and kind of failed at. He's always tried to spin a narrative where, he's the victim. He had nothing to do with it, that he's the innocent man. This was the case with the massages. I never had a massage. Well, yes, I did. Well, I kept my underwear on. She was 50 years old. My wife was in the room. You know, so he's had to walk back so many of these statements. And again, if you go through a lot of the back and forth conversations between Dershowitz and Guffrey's lawyers, Dershowitz, it looks bad. I mean, he admits to recording conversations secretly between him and her lawyers. He's played excerpts, not the full, you know, audio to, I believe it to Julie K. Brown at the Miami Herald. He's also in these, back and forth negotiations before the case was sort of settled between the two of them. He openly admits that his client, Jeffrey Epstein, is, was pimping out Guffrey. But he didn't. But Epstein didn't pimp out Guffrey to Dershowitz. He pimped her out to the former CTO of Microsoft. So again, admitting that his client is doing this, it's just she was having sex with other men at Epstein's behest. It just wasn't with me. She's just mistaken about the So he looks really bad. And he's just trying to spin this. He thinks that if he can get this narrative out there and he can, that's why he originally he wanted certain documents released ahead of time so that he could, again, craft the story that fits it, that fits his narrative, that he's innocent, that she's the liar. So I think that this is all kind of a smokescreen. And to sort of go back, I believe that that's what Cernovich is doing. It's now becoming, more and more people are waking up to things that myself and others were saying about Cernovich when he first became an intervener in this, that he's working for Dershowitz, that he is misrepresenting exactly what his original filing was about, which had nothing to do with the victim in this case, Virginia Roberts, Guffrey. But he was trying to unseal documents that made her look bad. And then, when Guffrey's lawyers filed a letter in a motion in opposition to his motion, he lied to his own followers while eliciting their money to fund his lawsuit and said that that motion came from Maxwell, when in fact it did not. So I think Mike is trying to spin this story as best he can because, he's becoming exposed. And even in conservative right-wing media, people are kind of waking up to this, that he's
– And he does have some type of, concrete connection to Dershowitz for people that are going to, question us on that.
Oh, of course. I mean, he interviewed Dershowitz for his film Silenced. And this was well after the fact that Dershowitz had, defended Epstein. Even Cernovich admits he was not the one that came up with this idea. He has sort of played fast and loose with his own timeline as to his involvement in this. It was his lawyer, Mark Randazza, that told Cernovich, hey, there's this lawsuit happening. You want me to file on your behalf about $10,000? Maybe we'll get some documents. So Cernovich, it wasn't even on his radar, which is more interesting. You know, what does he really know about this? Is was his information on this case coming from Dershowitz? Why does nobody Mike Cernovich will dig up people's tweets from 10 years ago claiming that they're pedophiles, you know, Pizzagate is real and all this stuff. Well, he's hanging out with Alan Dershowitz. And nobody seems to question that. I mean, he's got a lot of his followers, you know, wrapped around his finger. But it's important, too, to note that he was crowdfunding for this. So, I mean, that's – I don't know if that amounts to fraud necessarily, but it's certainly ethically unsound. So I think that Cernovich is also a little bit scared. There have been I've seen these rumors floating around. It's been reported by other people like journalist William Craddock, who's written some stuff about Cernovich as well, that you know, the word on the street is that Cernovich will not accept any interviews with you know, podcast hosts or other media outlets if they bring up Alan Dershowitz. You know, and we should note too, like who what does Cernovich do? He was in New York when this happened, and he was at a bar where he was answering some questions when someone in the audience brought up Alan Dershowitz. The live stream to Periscope cut out, and then other than that, he went on cult leader Stefan Molyneux's podcast, you know, which was all these sort of softball questions. So, I think it's a similar thing. He's trying to come out.
I want to say real quick, I mean, Dershowitz wasn't just the lawyer for Epstein. I mean, he helped negotiate a non-prosecution deal for Epstein. And now he's going around in a New York Magazine profile that was published, I believe, on Friday, where he said that he never had a, quote, close personal relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And it's funny because it brings us to another person in this sordid saga who's actually been trying to expose it like you and Ed Opperman have been doing. The investigative reporter Vicky Ward has sort of been on the warpath with the Dershowitz now, because she says that when she covered Epstein in 2003, Dershowitz described a much warmer relationship with Epstein that was close and personal.
Oh, I mean, that's 100% accurate. Now, Dershowitz can claim that they were never close, but I mean, his own quotes in the media would kind of refute that. I mean, there's two very famous quotes that have circulated that Dershowitz told. I believe one was to Vicky Ward, and one might have been to New York Magazine, which did another piece on Epstein, where we get the famous Trump quote about him being a terrific guy. The two quotes, and I'm paraphrasing these, but people can definitely look them up. They're not hard to find. One of the quotes is from Dershowitz saying something to the effect of, and this is describing how much he looks up to Epstein. He says something to the effect of, when I'm working on a manuscript, there's only two people that get to read it, you know, before I send it to my publisher. One is my wife. The other is Jeffrey Epstein. And then the other quote, which I'm paraphrasing again, is something about Dershowitz said, even if I was bankrupt and had no money, I would still be hanging out with Jeffrey down on the boardwalk at Coney Island eating hamburgers. I don't know why you wouldn't eat a hot dog if you're at the boardwalk in Coney Island. But apparently Dershowitz eats hamburgers. But I guess that's, you know, he also keeps his underwear on when he gets a massage and all these other things. But I mean, Dershowitz can say whatever the hell he wants. I mean, he seems to be in a position right now where he's just throwing everything at the wall. And he's just hoping that something sticks. So, yeah, I mean, it's just he can claim that they weren't close. That's not what the public record seems to show. This is also, it wasn't that long ago that he was quoted in Vox as saying something like that he, you know, he's still in contact with Epstein and, you know, he's my, he's still my client, blah, blah, blah. And I'm still talking with him. Now he's saying, oh, I haven't spoken to him in a while. So, I mean, there's like, you know, again, check out this Vox article where he claims to still be in contact with him and that he's still his lawyer. Now, I don't know what that means. If Dershowitz believes in some sort of like blood in, blood out, you know, once a lawyer, always a lawyer for somebody. That's not really the case, you know. I mean, just because you represent somebody at some point in their life doesn't mean that you're always their lawyer. So again, Dershowitz can spin this however he wants. I mean, that's just not factually accurate. And I think that he knows this. I think he's, like I said, throwing everything at the wall, hoping that something sticks and that there are. And believe me, you go on Twitter, you still see people defending Dershowitz. And certainly, you know, he's become a darling of the MAGA crowd. They all love him since he started coming out supporting Trump, you know, every time he sneezes. So, my personal opinion, Dershowitz is screwed. I don't think he's really going to be able to weather this one. And I think that, you know, at the very best case scenario, his entire career is forever tarnished. And that
this is the guy that was a second string lawyer for O.J. Simpson. That's how he got famous. I don't think he has as much plausible deniability. Or, you know, he doesn't have the same, you know, it's not going to be as easy for him as it will be for maybe a Bill Clinton or even a Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Dershowitz is, you know, is a media whore, however you want to look at it. And his whole career is so predicated on being this larger than life figure, be it Klaus von Bülow, be it his outsized, you know, influence in the O.J. In the O.J. case, I mean, Dershowitz is a tertiary character. You know, he was not Johnny Cochran. He was not Carl Douglas. He wasn't Barry Scheck. He wasn't even Robert Shapiro. You know, I mean, he was very low on the totem pole. He makes that, you know, he makes that into a big thing. He certainly likes to use that. But yeah, you know, his career is much more about being a TV attorney. So now I think when the history books are written, there's going to be a huge footnote about his connection with Jeffrey Epstein. Beyond that, though, I do think that there could be more legally that comes out that might screw him. Certainly, I mean, there seem to be some questions of like ethics violations if he was secretly recording conversations between him and lawyers of a woman who was suing him. I don't know. I'm not a legal expert, but I don't think that's that might, you know, violate bar association rules. But yeah, I think Dershowitz is probably screwed. And there's already questions about getting around some of the non-prosecution agreement stuff related to the Palm Beach case. If that is true, does that affect Dershowitz? I mean, the rumor and the speculation has always been that when Dershowitz and other lawyers for Epstein negotiated this non-prosecution agreement for any, you know, unnamed, unindicted co-conspirators, that he was protecting himself in that. Now, if that goes away, is Dershowitz open for prosecution? I don't know.
Well, I was going to say, I don't want to focus too much on it, but it just seems like everyone is running for cover right now over this. I mean, I'm seeing articles come out about Steven Pinker's involvement with Epstein now. And I mean, of course, you have the whole Donald Trump thing where Trump says he wasn't a fan of Epstein. But, you know, we have the 2002 piece where he says Epstein, he's a terrific guy. You have the 1992 footage of Epstein and Trump attending a party with NFL cheerleaders at Mar-a-Lago. You have Clinton. The Clintons released a statement being like, well, yeah, we're not like this Epstein guy. You know, we don't really like this dude.
Oh, and Clinton's is maybe one of the most laughable, where he said, oh, I only flew on his plane 4 times. That's just factually inaccurate based on the flight logs. Now, unless Larry Viscosi, who's one of Epstein's longtime pilots, unless he was lying and entered in like 20 false times that Clinton flew on the plane, it's just wrong. I mean, Clinton flew on the plane, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 26 times. So, I mean, that's wrong, obviously. I mean, it hasn't come out yet. Nobody seems to want to touch it. But there is also the letter by Gerald Lefcourt, one of Epstein's attorneys back in 2007, 2008 during the investigation, that, you know, Gerald Lefcourt wrote this letter, which, among other things, quotes Steven Pinker as a linguistic expert to basically come up with this verbal diarrhea as to how Epstein wouldn't have known that these children were underage and whatever. And also in that same letter is the assertion that Epstein was a founding member of the Clinton Foundation. So, I mean, that's now if that's the case, I mean, this predates the very first time that Bill Clinton flew on Epstein's plane, which supposedly was, I think, in the early 2000s, alongside Chris Tucker and Kevin Spacey. So, you know, that's never been – I mean, at some point, Bill is going to have to explain that one. And much the same way that the media has not picked up on this, even though, like you said, I mean, everybody is kind of talking about it. Why did Bill Clinton invite Maxwell to Chelsea Clinton's wedding, you know, years after it had all come out that she was a pimp? So, yeah, I mean, they're all running for cover, and I think that they're kind of like, you know, they're slipping up. In much the same way now we're seeing, you know, Katie Couric puts out an official statement now, even though it's been out for years that she attended this party when Epstein got out of prison that was ostensibly for Prince Andrew, but it also seems like it was sort of his, you know, get-out-of-jail party, where she said, oh, that was the first and only time I met him, and I hated it, and I never went back, and I regret it. Which she's only saying that publicly now that it's come, you know. So everyone kind of has like a weak response for why they were with him, what they were doing. I mean, I just saw the Washington Examiner had a piece up this morning, and they were talking about this this pilot that I just mentioned, Larry Viscasi. And I'll try and pull up the article. So it's a pilot's deleted Instagram sheds light on jet-setting Epstein's travel. And this is Larry, and it's Viscasi is spelled V-I-S-O-S-K-I. There is a deposition that he gave, which is probably the most extensive deposition of anyone associated with within Epstein's organization. I can give you the link for that, JG, if people want to go through it, because there's a lot of little interesting stuff in there. Anyway, this guy still works for Epstein. There's a picture of him and Kellyanne Conway. Now, it looks like they was maybe in the airport at Palm Beach. Kellyanne Conway, you know, claims that she says she told the Washington Examiner she did not remember taking that specific picture, but allowed people she said were unfamiliar to her to take selfies with her at Palm Beach International after she arrived from New York for meetings with the then president-elect. It's possible, but again, of all the, you know, the people she runs into, it's Captain Big Dog on Instagram. He's now deleted his Instagram account. I mean, everybody has got a weak, response to this, which I think is very telling as to the extensive relationships Epstein had with, it seems like, everybody.
Well, you know, I mentioned Vicky Ward earlier. I find it interesting. I've been reading another book, Chasing Cosby, by Nicole Egan. I believe she writes for the Daily Beast right now. But she was talking in the book about how when she was covering the Cosby case, even before it became a big thing, she had stories about it squashed. Because, you know, Cosby exercised his sort of power threatening to sue and whatnot. And I see a similarity there because now Vicky Ward is also saying when she did the Vanity Fair profile, it didn't tell the whole story and she was sort of silenced in a way.
Yeah, and she wrote an article about that years later. But, I think I want to say in like the 2015, 2016 timeframe, it might have even been a little bit earlier than that, Vicky Ward wrote this piece that was in the Daily Beast about her experience doing the Vanity Fair piece, which does seem to have been squashed by Graydon Carter, who at the time was the editor of Vanity Fair. We should note for people keeping track of all this, and I know it's a little confusing, There were two in Vicki Ward's original story that was basically cut out of the Vanity Fair piece, which she then later talked about in the Daily Beast. She had interviewed two young girls and their mother, and these two girls claimed that Epstein had abused them. Now, one of those victims has since come out publicly. Her name is Maria Farmer. She has joined on another lawsuit involving Guthrie and others against Epstein that is also ongoing, along with this, I believe, Sarah Ronsum, who is also known as Jane Doe 43, has joined in this lawsuit as well. Maria Farmer is this woman in question who Vicki Ward spoke to. Maria Farmer, at one point, I believe, worked in Epstein's house as like a front door person, where she claims in an affidavit that she, you know, was there numerous times that Dershowitz came in when there were underage, you know, when there were children in the house as well. Maria Farmer also claims, I think it was in, she was in Ohio at Les Wexner's estate when Maxwell and Epstein tried to sexually assault her. And she also claims that her younger sister was molested or raped in New Mexico at Epstein's I think it's called the El Toro Ranch or something like that. I'll try to find the exact name because he has some dumbass name for it. And also Maria Farmer in this affidavit also claims that her and her younger sister were at a movie with Epstein, and Epstein, you know, molested his her sister during the movie. So, you know, again, that, you know, backs up Vicki Ward's claims. And, you know, Graydon Carter, it really doesn't shock me that he would do this. Barrett Brown has tweeted in support of Vicki Ward, saying that that was his own experience when he was a contributor to Vanity Fair. He even he tweeted screenshots of emails he had with, I think his editor at the time. And his editor was basically saying, was somebody, I can't remember who Barrett Brown was writing about. The editor basically said, listen, he's a good friend of Graydon. It's not going to happen. So just, let it go. Also, now I don't remember the specifics of when Graydon Carter left Vanity Fair, but I'm pulling it up right now. We'll try to see. And it would be interesting. Okay, so until 2017. Now, I believe this was reported in, I think it was the Hollywood Reporter had an article, and they've done a few articles about Epstein's and his friends and his connections to people in, Hollywood. But, yes, so Graydon Carter was still the editor of Vanity Fair until 2017. Maybe your listeners may not be up on the Oscars, but the Vanity Fair Oscar part in 2014, Maxwell was at the 2014 Vanity Fair Oscar party. So again, this leads more credence to the idea, and certainly Graydon Carter was at that event. That being the editor of a huge outlet like that, You may not know every single little thing that's going on, and certainly you don't want to know. That's why you have subordinates, that can kind of like, if a butler, sees a roach, the queen doesn't even know about it. You know, you just stomp that out, and that's it. So it's possible that Graydon Carter doesn't know these things. It's interesting though that he seems to have squashed a lot of these stories, and he conceivably was at events that Maxwell was at. And on that same note, this is something that I wasn't even aware about. There's a really good Twitter user who I've been a longtime follower of, and vice versa. You might even follow him as well. He goes by the name Gumby for Christ, and that's Gumby the number 4 Christ. He dug up some really interesting pictures of Maxwell at several events that hosted by the founder and editor of the Daily Beast, Tina Brown, and a party that Brown and Vicky Ward co-hosted, and numerous events. One, I think, as late as 2014-15, hosted by the Daily Beast. So, you know, these big-time editors, I think we need to kind of look a little closely. What were they doing? I mean, the same can be said for the New York Times, which has been publishing multiple stories every day since Epstein has been arrested, including they had a story where it was entitled Inside Epstein's $56 Million Mansion, Photos of Bill Clinton, Woody Allen, and Saudi Crown Prince. In that article, the New York Times seems to have at least two sources that they know about that have been in Epstein's house in the past year or so. Now, there's no way that the New York Times just stumbled on these people. One of these guys that they or women, I'm not sure, one of these unnamed people that they quote was in Epstein's house a few months ago. So one of the bizarre things they talk about on the second floor of Epstein's giant mansion in New York on 71st Street on the East Side is this mural that was commissioned a few years ago, and it is a photorealistic prison scene that includes barbed wire, corrections officers, and a guard station with Epstein portrayed in the middle. And according to R. Corey Hay, who's a very influential PR person, PR specialist, who was invited to Epstein's 3 months ago, he said, quote, he said that Epstein said, quote, "That's me, and I had this painted because there is always a possibility that could be me again." So there's questions about, you know, editors at the New York Times. How long have they been sitting on some of these stories? You know, along with this bizarre, you know, with R. Corey Hay being at Epstein's house 3 months ago, there was another unnamed person who visited the townhouse last year who saw a signed photo of Bill Clinton. And there was another unnamed person that was there. It might have been for a business meeting. He claimed that Epstein pointed out to him this picture of him and Mohammed bin Salman. Now, I mean, when was that taken? Who the hell even knew about MBS until a few years ago? So, I mean, is that a recent picture? Or does, you know, I mean, there's already reports floating around, that Epstein and the Saudis go way back. So maybe he knew Mohammed bin Salman for years.
Well, you know, moving into another area with this, because we've talked about the sort of media side of it. Now there's a lot of heat coming down additionally on Rick Bradshaw, I guess, who is part of the Palm Beach Police Department. And just how they sort of handled Epstein. I found a lot of the details fascinating. On our first episode, we talked about his work release program. That's being covered now. That he was basically allowed out of prison, do his work with a foundation that he set up shortly before he went to prison and then dissolved shortly after he got out of prison. And, you know, it's such an insane thing, all these details I was reading about. I mean, there were security guys jockeying for position to be like people that worked at the prison that were jockeying for position to be his private security, which I can understand why they were doing that, because, you know, they were being offered like, you know, $60 an hour. Mm. You know, it's corruption on a very systemic level. Right. What do you make of the whole the Palm Beach aspect? The fact that he was sending friendly letters to people like Rick Bradshaw and the department after he got out of prison, you know, it just seems like massive conflicts of interest.
Yeah, well, let's keep in mind Epstein donated money to the Palm Beach Police Department. I believe it's one of the charities that he gave to over the years was a like Palm Beach Police Department charity as well. He, famously, he was in the, you know, basically a private wing of the prison there that, you know, he had helped donate money to build it. So, yeah, Rick Bradshaw is the, I believe is still the sheriff of Palm Beach. He might have retired. I'm not totally sure on that, so don't quote me on that. But he was the, you know, chief sheriff when Epstein was there. He did sign off on this ludicrous work release program. We should also mention it's not just Rick Bradshaw. There's also Barry Kircher, who is a state attorney in Palm Beach, who seems to – I don't know what Epstein has on this guy, and I'm speculating, but I think it's something big. Or Kircher just knows you don't go after, you know, you don't go after these people. I mean, because Kircher was basically ready to let Epstein walk free. He wasn't even going to, you know, he wasn't going to charge him with anything.
Well, I mean, in the paperwork, they only refer to him as inmate Epstein once. They repeatedly refer to him as Mr. Epstein.
Yes, and they're you know, in Julie K. Brown's the original three-part series she put out, Perversion of Justice, on the she goes into more detail about some of the stuff that, you know, between you know, Bradshaw, Kircher, and there's a few other slimy characters that we can touch on as well in that. But yeah, she goes into more detail about that, including things like, you know, like you said, that there were and I don't think they were private security. I think they were actually police in Palm Beach that were assigned to his security detail. But yeah, that people were trying to get there. You know,
they were paid extra, though. They were paid.
Yes,
like,
they were absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Out of Epstein's own pocket. They were on, you know, Epstein's employ when it came to that. There are also, you know, it's being reported more and more now that there are, you know, there were instances where they were not properly signing in his guests. So anyone that technically speaking, Epstein was allowed to leave the lockup and go to an office that he had in Palm Beach. So he was never supposed to go to his house. As far as I know, I don't believe he was ever in his house, but I may be wrong about that. My understanding was that he was able to go to his office. At his office, though, he was only ever allowed to be visited by two groups of people, his attorneys and his business partners. There are now media reports in a whole bunch of different papers alleging that that was not the case, that there were random people meeting him, that there were women meeting him. I don't know what their age was specifically, but that was not allowed. There are media reports out there talking about the fact that, you know, he had closed door meetings with some of these people, which was also was not supposed to be allowed. There are now media reports talking about, you know, he would spend an exorbitant amount of time at Home Depot and I think another store. I can't remember off the top of my head. Things like that, excursions, you know, for shopping or even haircuts, were supposed to be limited to like once a month. It seems that they were letting Epstein go there like daily. Along with that, there was a report that Epstein got picked up just sort of walking on the street by himself, and he was, you know, sweating, so he had been out there for a while. That was not supposed to be happening, but they apparently just sort of let him, you know, go for a nice leisurely walk.
I was told I was reading reports that were saying that some of the people that did security were like, well, how are we supposed to, like, what are the details? How are we supposed to handle this guy? And, like, nothing was really made clear to them. I find the security stuff interesting because I think the way things like these scandals can happen is largely because, you know, the people at the lower levels, I mean, I don't think the security people necessarily know what's up. They're just like, well, I can make a good amount of money off this today. Like, they're not thinking about, you know, who Epstein is or any of that stuff. So I think it's interesting because it gives an insight into how horrible things like these, you know, the whole Epstein saga can happen, just systemically, structurally.
Oh,
if
yeah.
You have the money.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think it also this illustrates a much larger issue about corruption in law enforcement and justice and how easy it is. I'll point people because when we're giving credit for people that have been out front about this story, Jane Musgrave, a great reporter who writes for the Palm Beach Post. She has been covering Epstein since 2006 and has continued to do really good stories. People should really check her out. And she has an article up that's just a few days old. Jeffrey Epstein, model prisoner who swept mop floors, officials say. She has a video interview with the chief deputy talking about Epstein as this, you know, great model prisoner and whatnot. But she also has reported on these, trips to Home Depot and the Sports Authority, which were highly unusual, it turns out, where he would spend, quote, large blocks of time in Home Depot and Sports Authority, according to his daily probation logs. One day, he reportedly spent 4 hours at Home Depot on Palm Beach Lakes Boulevard. Another day, he spent most of the day from 11:30 to 5 p.m. at the two stores, records show. Even though Correction Department guidelines said that shopping for personal items and getting a haircut is limited to once a month, officials didn't question his trips. What was he actually doing at Home Depot and Sports Authority? Who was he talking to? Not to get like too kind of paranoid and stuff, but you don't spend, 5 or 6 hours going to these two. I mean, first off, what could he possibly be buying? He still had to go back to prison that day. You know, they're not letting him like take a, you know, is he going to Home Depot to get tools to, you know, break out of prison? I don't think so. So, I mean, to me, that's a question of, was there someone else at these locations that he was there to meet, to give a signal to? I mean, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities. There's also another instance where the Palm Beach police accused him of violating his probation after they found him walking along South Ocean Boulevard, quote, sweating profusely at about 5 p.m. one day. Jane Musgrave is also in this article, confirmed, that he regularly got permission to fly to New York, Boston, and Miami, and that he also flew back and forth between Little St. James and the prison. I don't know exactly, but I mean, were the people that were supposed to be watching it, I mean, were they going to Little St. James, or were they just kind of letting him go there on his own? I mean, that's insane to me.
Well, I mean, all I'm hearing is, there will be an internal investigation. There will be an internal investigation.
Yes.
And, the excuse is that, we had to treat Mr. Epstein differently because, you know, he would have trouble adjusting to prison life. He's a special case.
Yeah, right.
It's the same old story over and over, you know. Like I said, the way wealth and power works in this country, I mean, you look at the Epstein case, you look at the Cosby case. I mean, this is sort of how power relations operate at this level.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are rules for, people like Epstein, and there are rules for the rest of us. And evidently, you know, Epstein. But to me, I think this goes a little bit beyond, kind of special treatment for. I think I don't know what, but I think people had to have been leaned on to give him some of this sort of stuff. Because, I mean, again, this you don't have to be like a gumshoe detective, you know, to figure out that if he's spending this much time almost every day in two stores, I mean, what's going on there? What is he doing? He's not just shopping.
Even the fact that he starts this foundation for the work release thing, right?
Right.
He starts the foundation shortly before prison and then shuts it down shortly after. And it is different than the kind of special treatment we usually hear about. You know, like, if I think of someone like Jordan Belfort, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street, he ended up in a country club prison.
But, you know, Epstein's basically only in prison when he needs to go to sleep.
Mm. Yeah. No, definitely. And, yeah, I mean, right. The whole thing is I don't know. It's shocking that, I mean, like I said, I think this kind of also just illustrates the bigger problems, not just in terms of corruption, but just like law enforcement in general, that he was allowed to get away with this, that he was allowed to do these sort of things. And like you said, I mean, what's the response? Oh, we're going to look into it. You know, I mean, that's the other thing, too. It's like not only is everybody that was ever associated with him trying to deflect that, but now you see every, you know, Palm Beach is looking into this. New Mexico is finally investigating Epstein and what he was doing there. So, you know, all of these law enforcement bodies that are supposed to be there to protect, you know, the innocent people, to protect children at the very least. Now they're all suddenly kind of running around trying their best to, you know, figure this out.
Well, I mean, the most bizarre part of it in a lot of ways is, you know, I think Ed Opperman said recently on one of his shows, you know, the whole Epstein sex trafficking, this was like a very sloppy operation from the beginning on his part. And I think there's truth to that, like, because there's such a mass of evidence against Epstein. I'm like, how could you, you know, it just seems like what was going on with people like Epstein, like this would never come to head in their mind.
I don't know. I mean, there's obviously the theory that seems to be gaining in popularity both in the alternative media and in the mainstream media is that, you know, this was allowed to go on because of his connections to intelligence, whatever those may be. That's certainly one possibility. I think Epstein, if we were looking just specifically at him, I think he believed that he could get away with anything. I think he you know, felt that he had enough dirt on other people that, you know, he had the juice to basically, he could have made all of this go away in Palm Beach if it wasn't for the Palm Beach PD complaining to the you know, federal authorities to get involved. And even when they got involved, he basically got away with it anyway. So, you know, now I don't know. Is that Epstein having enough juice to make these things go away? Probably. Is that Epstein having some sort of a connection to intelligence? Entirely likely. I think that, you know, I know it's a touchy subject, and, I got a whole slew of people, you know, saying, you know, I let off Epstein on the Mossad stuff and whatever, and, you know, I'm a secret Jew and – you know, whatever.
Well, I want to say real quick. So the reason for this Mossad angle, beyond the fact that the Epstein, you know, it's a Jewish name, right, is I guess Maxwell, his, you know, main pimp, she's the daughter of Robert Maxwell, who it's pretty, you know, much an open secret that he worked for Mossad.
Yeah, and those allegations about Maxwell, they're like, I mean, they've almost kind of become just sort of like accepted in large part. Now,
I think there was even an Israeli politician that said, you know, what Robert Maxwell has done for this country, you know, it'll be recognized in the future, but not right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, I mean, he's right. I mean, at least at the, I don't know. I mean, if at the very least, Israeli intelligence wants us to believe that he, you know, he worked for, that they were in partnership. I don't totally dismiss that. Maxwell's death is very mysterious. There have been rumors about that. I mean, Seymour Hersh also wrote about Maxwell's involvement with Israeli intelligence. I think particularly when it came to his role in Israel acquiring nuclear weapons, Maxwell is mentioned in that, I think, in the Samson option by Seymour Hersh. So, yeah, I mean, that's there. And obviously all intelligence agencies use sexual blackmail. That's not specific to Mossad. It's not specific to the CIA, to the FSB, to anything. That's just, you know, that, I mean, and that probably goes back to you know, ancient Babylon or whatever. So that's there. I think at the same time, though, the Mossad thing is you can't – I kind of dance around it because to me it kind of my problem with it is that it does enter into the realm of Mossad is behind everything, which kind of leads into a like Jews are behind everything, because when, you know, Vicky Ward came out and said that she was told that when Acosta was questioned about Epstein during, you know, with the transition team before Trump got into the White House, he said, don't worry, it's nothing. And that Acosta told them that he was told to like back off because Epstein was above his pay grade because he was some sort of an intelligence asset.
And Acosta just resigned, as we all know,
from
the Trump administration.
And when Acosta was asked about those comments, he didn't really deny them. You know, he just said that he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't put much stock in it or whatever. And then he said that, you know, there's a lot of people going down rabbit holes, which to me didn't, you know, okay. I mean, there's lots of, just because it's a rabbit hole doesn't mean that it's not true. You know, it might just be like a crazy, insane thing. But he didn't really deny it, which is telling. I don't know why he wouldn't just come out and say, no, that's not correct. Now, again, everyone is jumping on this is Mossad, because of Maxwell, and I think by extension because Epstein is Jewish. My one problem with that is, and it's possible that this is true, but are we then posing the idea that Acosta was a good guy and he wanted to take down Epstein, but a Mossad agent approached him and told him to stop, or a member within the DOJ that works for Mossad told him to stop? I mean, does Mossad have that kind of juice? I don't know. I'm sure that Mossad has agents in the FBI and the DOJ in much the same way that the CIA has agents inside Shin Bet and Mossad and you know, their equivalent of the Department of Justice. I'm sure that's the case, but I don't know. To me, it kind of enters into that realm of, like, you know, the Jews are everywhere, Mossad is everywhere. And I also just – I'm not sure that Epstein needed to play that card at that moment. I mean, he seemed to have everything he wanted out of Acosta.
Well, I was going to say real quick too. I mean, I just think the intelligence agency aspect gets really murky. And I'm prone to looking at the wealth and power aspect. Maybe that's my own bias. But it's funny you mentioned Seymour Hersh. Seymour Hersh said at one point, there was one story in Seymour Hersh's life that he always felt weird about covering. And it was Sidney Korshak, who was like the mob guy in L.A. and Hollywood, and he was connected to the movie industry. And he said after he did that story, the way that people tried to shut that story down, he was spooked by it. And he said, I don't want to cover, like, private corporate corruption and wealthy people. I'm just going to cover state stuff now. And I can see that happening with the Epstein thing, too.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think I definitely got some flack, and it's just like flack on YouTube, right? So it's like all like neo-Nazis and anti-Semites that comment. But I think, and I even kind of got into a little, like, not argument, but like disagreement with Ed over this. I was kind of downplaying some of the intelligence stuff only because I don't know where it really goes. And I don't know that, like, it, I don't know. My feeling has always been that I would rather, you know, I'd rather see Epstein and his conspirators rot in prison.
That's the big thing about this, too. I don't mean to interrupt you again, but that's the big thing about this. I'm kind of sick of seeing people use this for their own political agenda, whether it's to go after, you know, there's the people that want to say, well, it's all about Clinton, not about Trump. It's all about Trump, not about Clinton. It's about the Mossad. And it's like you have dozens of girls that were abused. And we're going to use this for our politics. It's a little bit
disgusting. Right. And also to fit our worldview about intelligence, right? Now, let me just say that obviously I've studied the intelligence services involvement in things as seemingly benign as Hollywood. So why they wouldn't be involved in Epstein is, I do believe there's something there. Now, let me just parse that out a little bit, and then we can switch gears if you want to. Because again, I mean, this is kind of one of the problems is like, where do you go with this? There's a lot of speculation, you know, and I saw a lot of people criticizing me for poo-pooing the Mossad stuff, and they say, well, you know, Mossad connections are so obvious, you know, because they're Mossad connections. But they're not really giving anything like, okay, beyond Maxwell's father, like, what else is there? Now, there does seem to be some kind of a deeper connection between Epstein and Ehud Barak. And Netanyahu has kind of hammered on that. And I believe that Barak and Epstein like owned a company together in Israel. So again, and Ehud Barak, military intelligence, obviously former prime minister of Israel. I mean, yeah, this guy is up to his eyeballs in intelligence connections. So it's not inconceivable. But let me just say this, that why are we jumping to the conclusion that it has to just be Mossad? Why wouldn't the CIA be comfortable or be working with this guy? And that goes all the way back to, you know, things that what's his name? I can't remember. He was involved with Henry Vincent, one of the D.C. madams. I think his name was Carl Spence. He was the crack addicted CIA blackmailer who was doing all sorts of nefarious things with, you know, kids and getting politicians and, you know, in compromising position with, you know, male politicians with other men. So, I mean, obviously the CIA does this sort of thing all the time. Why wouldn't they be working Epstein? The same kind of goes to the, oh, Maxwell must be, is, you know, Mossad because her father was. The same allegations were made about Maxwell and MI6, that Robert Maxwell worked for MI6. So, and certainly that makes kind of sense when we factor in people like Prince Andrew. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that the royal family is working with MI6 or whatever, but certainly British intelligence is aware of when royals are hanging out with known pedophiles. I mean, that's part of their whole, you know, thing. Why are we dismissing all of these other intelligence agencies? Is it because Mossad is sexier? It's more fun? Is it because it fits whatever particular worldview that we have? Also, just Mossad and the CIA work hand in glove all the time. You know, it could be a joint operation. Or more to the point that I've been leaning towards, or at least exploring more, is that what if Epstein was somewhat unaware of all of this, that he was being, you know, puppeted, that someone within his organization could have been reporting back to Mossad, CIA, MI6, or others, you know, just simply saying, listen, you know, Epstein is a blackmailer, but maybe they don't want him to be in the loop on all of this. That's entirely possible. Or maybe, you know, we were sort of chatting about this before we were recording. Maybe, you know, Maxwell is the puppeteer. I mean, she certainly seems to be getting away with a lot more, you know, recently in terms of, you know, she's a much lower media profile than Epstein at the moment. So
I do see a lot of media spotlight on her now, but yeah.
Yeah, there is absolutely in the past like week or so, there has been more. But again, I find it interesting that like some of the key things like Maxwell at Chelsea Clinton's wedding aren't being explored, or the fact that Donald Trump held up his plane in like 2001, 2002 in Palm Beach. So Epstein, Maxwell, and what appeared to be an underage girl could get on the plane. That was in the Maximum Golf magazine. And Maxwell is in that video, that 1992 video with Epstein and Trump at Mar-a-Lago. Maxwell's in the background. So, I mean, they're not piecing together all of that. I think the intelligence stuff to me is, I think it's fascinating, and I do think it's there, and I think that it's fine to explore it. I just personally, I don't know fully where it leads for me, and I don't know. I just, I I've always been more about understanding the nature of who Epstein is on a like psychological level, and understanding the network that he created, his immediate network: Epstein, Maxwell, Sarah Kellen, Leslie Groff, Malyashev, Marchenkova, Vaskasi, all of these people, Jean-Luc Brunel, who are floating around. Also, Epstein didn't necessarily need intelligence connections to get a lot of the stuff that he was getting. Jean-Luc Brunel was able to get visas for all of those models at MC2 modeling. He's even alleged to be able to get passports, the same way that Trump's modeling agency was getting visas for kids as young as like 13. So, did he need the CIA to step in? I don't know. I do have questions about how Epstein eluded so much, and that he seemed to be totally unaware of the federal indictment. You know, why would he ever return from France if he knew he was going to be arrested? That to me does have a smells a little bit like a intel thing, that he was told you're safe, that you've been protected from on high, you're okay. That to me kind of, and again too, he's got so much blackmail on so many politicians and business people that if you were working in any intelligence agency, you would be a fool not to want to try to get that info. And sorry, JG, just one final thing. It's coming out now, again, Vicky Ward, who seems to be one of these people that's been giving these nuggets about the intelligence stuff, she's heard rumors that Epstein, back in the 80s, and I've talked about this on your show before, that Epstein was known in the mid early to mid 80s as a guy that could help get people's money back if it was stolen, or to help protect money. I talked about Ana Obregón, this Spanish heiress whose father was swindled out of money through this company called Drysdale Securities. Epstein helped get this money back. That's where Epstein also formed some sort of relationship with this federal prosecutor, Robert Gold, who, according to Steve Hoffenberg, protected Epstein later during the Ponzi scheme. At that same time, Vicky Ward has heard rumors that Epstein was hobnobbing with none other than Adnan Khashoggi. So, there seems to be a Saudi angle to this. It's being alleged that this passport, this expired passport that they confiscated in Epstein's New York mansion, listed his residence as Saudi Arabia. He's got pictures of him and Mohammed bin Salman. So is this Saudi intelligence? I know that nobody likes to look at the Saudis. I've come into this problem sort of off topic a bit, but I can't talk about 9/11 on my show unless it's all only about Israel and Mossad. We can't talk about the Saudi involvement. Is this like the Mossad behind everything? Is that some sort of a cover for the Saudis to be able to operate in the dark?
Well, I wanted to ask you about this decoy passport that they found, because my first reaction, and maybe I'm being too lenient here, is, well, is it really that odd for one of the super wealthy to have a fake passport?
No, I don't think so. Stumbling over my own words here. It's not uncommon, and obviously that's what Epstein's lawyers have put out there. They have,
They're saying it wasn't his. They're saying it was given to him by a friend, and it was like some fake passport that someone made, and he just happened to get a hold of it.
So yeah. Their
explanation is very bizarre.
Absolutely. Yeah. So their original letter where they first addressed the passport is in a long letter. And this is in relation to arguments against the prosecutors involving the bail hearing. So they say that this Austrian passport. So they didn't initially name who it was. So it says it's an Austrian passport. And I'm quoting from this is Epstein's defense attorney, his attorneys. This is what they said, quote, As for the Austrian passport the government trumpets, it expired 32 years ago, and the government offers nothing to suggest and certainly no evidence that Epstein ever used it. In any case, Epstein, an affluent member of the Jewish faith, acquired the passport in the 1980s when hijackings were prevalent in connection to Middle East travel. The passport was for personal protection in the event of travel to dangerous areas, only to be presented to potential kidnappers, hijackers, or terrorists should violent episodes occur. Now, I don't doubt that that was a thing that people did, and certainly in the 80s and definitely, you know, 70s and the 80s, hijackings were prevalent. Now, why is Epstein, a quote, affluent member of the Jewish faith traveling to, you know, countries where this might happen? I don't know. I mean, that raises questions. You know, you would think. And also at the time, this is in the early 80s. I mean, how affluent was Epstein, really? I mean, this.
Well, I was going to say real quick, when they said affluent member of the Jewish faith, I was thinking to myself, yeah, but he wasn't always that. That's what is so weird about Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, he was like a public school kid. I think he was a teacher for a while, and then he just sort of accumulates all this wealth by getting into finance. It's just it's very, very like odd. It's a very odd like new money story, and that's sort of what I see Jeffrey Epstein as, like a nouveau riche, you know, maniac, basically. But I wonder where he got all of this.
Oh, of course. I mean, we you and I talked about this. This might have been almost like a year ago. Discussing how he accumulated this money. I mean, again, yeah, he gets fired from Bear Stearns for some sort of a SEC violation, but gets a bonus from Bear Stearns. Then he kind of bounces around. He continues to lose money by all accounts of people that knew him. He was not, you know, he couldn't really hold on to money. He was not a good investor. Every hedge fund, you know, there was a New York Magazine article written recently by one of their financial reporters who, asked like all the big hedge fund managers in New York what they thought of Epstein. They all thought that he was a total phony, that he was some sort of like a Bernie Madoff character, because he wasn't really making anything. Now, you know, again, they're talking about 32 years ago would be 1987. I believe this was after he had worked with Anna Obregon to get back this money. Now, when he helped her find her father's money, he was granted power of attorney so that he was able to basically get a cut of whatever the money was that was found. So that was in 1982. Now, 1987, which is what his attorneys are alleging, that would be around the same time that he was working with Steve Hoffenberg. And I don't know if that's just a rough estimate or what, but that's interesting. 87 is when he's working with Hoffenberg. Maybe they are traveling internationally, and maybe it does behoove them to have a fake passport. My question is, though, you have the fake passport. Do the terrorists not search you? Like, you're just like, oh, here's my passport. I'm an Austrian citizen whose residence is in Saudi Arabia. I mean, that they're just, you know, if you're a terrorist, are you going to be like, oh, okay, thank you. Like, that's it? Like, no further inspection? Come on. And then what if they find his other passport? The other question is this a real passport or is this a fake passport? That has not been fully answered yet. And I just want to read two other things, because this is where the passport story gets really interesting. And it does raise questions about intelligence connections. And I actually wonder, his connections to Saudi Arabia. In response to that letter, Jeffrey Berman, who I no relation that I know of to Richard Berman, who's the judge. Jeffrey Berman is a U.S. attorney. They submitted this letter. They said, quote, "The government respectfully submits this letter to briefly respond to one aspect of the defendant's July 16, 2019 letter and to provide the court with additional information regarding the defendant's foreign passport. The defendant's July 16, 2019 letter asserts, quote, as for the Austrian passport the government trumpets, it expired 32 years ago, and the government offers nothing to suggest and certainly no evidence that Epstein ever used it, end quote. In fact, the passport contains numerous ingress and egress stamps, including stamps that reflect use of the passport to enter France, Spain, the United Kingdom, and Saudi Arabia in the 1980s. The government further notes that the defendant's submission does not address how the defendant obtained the foreign passport, and more concerning, the defendant has still not disclosed to the court whether he is a citizen or legal permanent resident of a country other than the United States. Now, so now the government is alleging that this passport was being used. Now, I don't – now that's either a really good fake or it's a real passport. Now, Epstein's lawyers, this is from I think this was submitted by Mark Furnish, who's one of his lawyers. They sent a letter, you know, again, to the court, and I'll just read it, and then I'll throw it to you. Quote, Epstein was given the passport at issue by a friend. Some Jewish Americans were informally advised at the time to carry identification bearing a non-Jewish name when traveling internationally in case of hijacking. He never used the document to travel internationally and never presented it to any immigration or customs authority. The passport stamps predating his receipt of the document do not reflect Mr. Epstein's entries or exits. His expired U.S. passports seized by the government and in its possession would verify his true travel. The defense has asked the government to bring the original document to court for examination and inspection. And then they just go on to say that Mr. Epstein, you know, is a lifelong American citizen. So, I mean, number one, who's the friend, right? Who was the person that informally advised some Jewish Americans to carry fake passports? Now, are they saying even that the passport is fake or that it was real? They're also saying that, from what I gather here, he never used it internationally, but the passport stamps, which predated his receipt of the document, so I guess these were what, old stamps that – proceed, like, so are they fake stamps? You know, like, what are these? Did they get stamps that made it look like he had been using it? I mean, what's going on with this passport? The fact that it's been alleged that the country of residence is Saudi Arabia is interesting. These allegations that Epstein goes back to, you know, has some relationship with Adnan Khashoggi, it's unsubstantiated right now, but I mean, that's got to be CIA, right? And we're talking about it at a time, you know, Iran-Contra was going on. There were always questions about Khashoggi and his yacht, all these, you know, women that were on his yacht, the yacht that he sold to Donald Trump. there's one of two things happening here, too. I mean, either the government is lying about what's in this passport, or Epstein's lawyers are lying. So I don't know. I don't think that SDNY would lie like that. I don't know. But the passport issue is extremely interesting. I think that's one that we should see more of. I would love to see what this passport looked like, you know? And if it in fact is real or a fake. I mean, both of these questions are dangerous. You know, one, who's giving him a real passport? Is this the government of Austria? Is this Saudi Arabia? Or who's making this fake passport? And how good a fake is it?
Right. I mean, that even goes beyond the question of intelligence agencies, which, like I said, I'm a little bit more murky on. But it definitely raises questions of, like, well, where is he getting this from?
Exactly. And, I mean, you know, you can kind of go down that route of, like, only, you know, if it's that good of a fake, it's probably made by an intelligence agency. That's possible. You know, where do you go? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just also if it was a fake or if it was real, where was he getting these stamps? You know, I mean, is that something that you can just go and buy, you know, stamps for various countries, but from customs officials? I don't know. I don't think so. You know, so he's putting in fake stamps to show. The whole story is bizarre. Why did he keep it for 32 years? You know, why did he have it in his possession? That seems kind of bizarre.
Well, you know, I guess the other thing that's interesting is the assets. They were actually looking at his assets recently.
Yes. And Epstein's lawyers have been trying to kind of keep the financial disclosures to a minimum. They filed a motion to basically keep everything sealed, that he wouldn't have to publicly, you know, disclose his money, you know, or that he would do it, but it's going to take a little bit of time because it's so complex. And the government is obviously, you know, to say that this is unfair, this isn't normal. You know, why isn't he talking about these, you know, blah, blah, blah. They're saying that this is that he's hiding something. And there are certainly questions about how much money he really actually has. There's a really good reporter who works for I think it's Courthouse News, who at the press conference, the initial press conference that SDNY gave, he asked a question: is Epstein a billionaire? And the SDNY official basically said, "I'm not going to answer. You know, no comment," or something.
Well, I was going to say USA Today has an article that was updated. Let me see. It was updated at least by July 16th, 2019, and they write, a document posted in Epstein's federal court case docket on Monday showed that the financier self-certified his total assets at $559 million as of June 30th.
Yes, I've seen that too. So again, it's not the billion that he's alleged to have made. Even his assets on his house, I've seen those. The money that he's listed is not what other real estate people have listed. You know, he seems to be kind of inflating the wealth, you know, of his property somewhat. At the same time, I mean, he owns two islands in the Virgin Islands. He owns Little and Big St. James.
Well, I mean, he you know, the ultra wealthy are really good at hiding money too.
Yeah.
You know, offshore banks and whatnot. But there is that question of, like, is this guy actually a billionaire? I think that was always a question.
Yeah. Well, and you don't need to be a billionaire to live a life similar to Epstein's. I mean, you know, $500 million goes a long way. If you're, you know, like, or at least you can put on the appearance. I mean, he probably didn't pay anything except for a dollar to acquire the New York mansion. The Palm Beach estate is, I mean, cheesy at best. It looks very much like a motel, and you can look at the...
He's very gauche in his expressions of wealth.
Yeah, yes, yes. And I have not gone through them yet. I've just seen little bits and pieces. There is a YouTube user by the name of Rusty Shackelford, which is, I love the name, which is a reference to King of the Hill. That's Dale's alter, or the name that Dale uses to order pizza with, Dale being the conspiracy theorist in King of the Hill. But YouTube user has uploaded multiple videos that appear to be drone footage flying over Epstein's island. And even in some of those pictures, there's one where the drone is like at the, you know, the temple that everyone is obsessed with. The temple looks pretty cheap. So I don't know. I mean, is this kind of a facade? It's possible. Obviously, he has money because, I mean, just the international travel alone is not cheap. But is it as much as he says it is? I don't know. And like you said, though, JG, I mean, he could be hiding this money in some bank account in the Cayman Islands. He could have, you know, $2 billion tucked away. Obviously, I mean, one of the things that the government alleged to deny bail was that they uncovered $70,000 in cash and a bag full of loose diamonds. So obviously, I mean, you know, he's got money on hand. Now, $70,000 is not a lot of money, but that's certainly, I mean, that's a lot to me and you. That's a lot if you were trying to get out of the country, plus a bag of diamonds. And obviously, CD-ROMs, you know, videos that contain what's probably blackmail of prominent individuals. That's worth a lot of money too. One of the things is, I mean, you know, and people can, you know, the very wealthy, they don't pay anything. Okay, so like if you're super wealthy, you don't pay much in taxes. You know, even if you're just somewhat wealthy, you're not paying a lot in taxes. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing, though, is that the wealthy, or at least the people that we perceive to be wealthy, they get everything handed to them. They go to parties and they get gift bags that are worth, you know, $5,000. They go to hotels and everything is comped. If you're wealthy and you go to Vegas, you're not paying for anything as long as you gamble something. So how much of that played in Epstein's favor? You know, how much of his luxury was the fact that he was wealthy, or at least perceived to be wealthy, or at least wealthy enough that he could, you know, go to places and get everything kind of handed to him. So keep that in mind also. I mean, that's I don't know if that explains everything, but that's certainly one explanation.
Now, was there anything else they found? I've heard that – did they search his mansion?
Yeah, they searched the property on East 71st Street.
Okay, because I was hearing they found, like, pornography and all kinds of stuff indicating just how – I mean, it seems like he's – he reminds me of Robert Durst in a way. You know, also from New York, in that, like, Robert Durst, when you watch him in that series, The Jinx, he's just, like, this intensely impulsive person. Like, you know, his brother has a restraining order against him, and he decides to walk up to his brother's apartment anyways while the cameras are on him. And it's, like, Epstein is like that, but, like, taken to this, like, insane sexual level. He's just – he lives on impulse, it seems like.
Yeah, I think that – my theory of Epstein has always been that everything about him, this image of him being super wealthy, the image of him being this great intellectual mind, is all been basically a facade to facilitate his compulsion to abuse children. I think that's really if you break down Epstein, that's all that's really there. And, you know, there's really not much else to him beyond that. Now, obviously, he was sophisticated enough to you know, have this large network, and he felt safe enough for probably various reasons that he could kind of get away with it. But, yeah, I think that he's a really basic pedophile in a lot of ways. He just had the means to kind of do some crazy things like buying children from the Balkans, you know, or Yugoslavia.
Well, that's what I meant by it's he seems so sloppy about it. Like, he just, like, all of this is coming out now. It's like he didn't do a very good job of any of this. I mean, especially after, you know, the initial case. It's so bizarre to me.
Well, I think I agree with you. I mean, that's sort of why I've always found that some of the more far-fetched theories about Epstein are, you know, obviously I'm all for a good conspiracy, and I'm totally open to exploring more out there conspiracy theories about any number of topics, including Jeffrey Epstein. The supposed temple is bizarre. I remember years ago, when I was first looking into the Epstein stuff, I went on Google Earth and saw the temple. Nobody really cared about it. No, it was out there. You know, when did the temple become a cause célèbre amongst the alternative media? The same time that Pizzagate, you know, was coming out. So it's child sacrifice and occult worship. And yes, does the temple look a cult? Obviously. I think it's meant to be. There's some kind of, like, you know, golden statue on top. Is that a statue of Moloch? I don't think anyone can unequivocally say that it is. These people are also looking at the, you know, the temple, and they're seeing underground passages. I don't see that in any of the pictures. So, you know, where are they going with that? I don't know. That to me seems kind of like a dead end. Could it be a temple where he, performs satanic rituals on his victims? Sure. obviously these people are like, you know, what they are satanic in like the most literal sense. I mean, they are doing horrible things to people. So yeah, could he be doing that? Absolutely. Does that mean that he is somehow like clued into the Illuminati and the Rothschilds? I don't know. Although, you know, at the same time, according to Dershowitz, it was Lynn Rothschild that introduced them. So, you know, you kind of pop back and forth there. But to me, the temple is irrelevant. I don't really care. If he was abusing kids in the temple, he was abusing kids. It doesn't matter if he was doing it for some sort of occult ritual for Moloch, or, you know, the Illuminati or Mossad, or if that temple is just literally nothing but a few beds where he goes to abuse people. I mean, it could be a sauna. It could be any number of things. It's sort of irrelevant.
Well, I was going to say, it gets really, like, bizarre to me when we start talking about the temple. And I'm like, well, you know, Nicolas Cage has, you know,
right.
When he dies, he has this tomb that looks like a, you know, a cult symbol thing. And I'm like, well, was Nicolas Cage like committing child sacrifices for the Illuminati? Right. Is that the next thing we're going to say? If someone does weird artwork, are we going to say like, oh, they're Satanists like we did with Pizzagate? I'm like, it just gets to be too much, you know, and I think there's a serious issue at hand. We have this, you know, he's a serial sexual predator, and you know, people want to turn it into, oh, satanic ritual abuse, or, oh, you know, the Mossad. And I don't get it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right. That's my problem with the temple is like, cool, but like, where do you go? Do you have blueprints that show underground passages? If you do, let's look at them. You know, I mean, if that's the case, I'm for exploring it. I'm for, you know, I'm not dismissing it. I just don't know really where it goes. Is there a weird temple? Yes. Do we know what goes on there? No.
I'll be honest. I'm the type that has become prone to dismissing it, because to me it's like, unless you can show me, I'm not going to get into outlandish things that I can't prove. That's my issue with it. And that's the only problem I've had with the case so far is I think a lot of people have mucked it up.
Well, yes, and that's the loudest voices with the Epstein stuff, in the same way that, you know, like the loudest voices in any kind of horrific event always drown out everyone, are the most generally become the most sort of bizarre and out there. So Epstein doesn't become a case of a simple case of a person who is abusing children with seeming impunity. It becomes a question of the grand, global pedophile elite that's all, you know, working for Mossad and the Rothschilds. And this is really about taking down Trump, and this is the deep state, and you know, and it misses
QAnon.
QAnon, of course, yeah. QAnon didn't see any of this coming, I don't think. It misses all of that, you know, and it doesn't talk about like the actual victims that are involved in this. It makes them seem like they're non-people. That they're just, I mean, you know, it's also like there are a bunch of these people are all alive as far as we know. They're out there. And we give them no agency to be their own people. I don't know if that's deliberate, but it certainly works in Epstein's favor to an extent, because people aren't looking at the court documents which lay out all this stuff. I mean, one of the things that's there's this a photo that's, I think, from one of Guffrey's letters, and it shows like the plane routes that Epstein was taking. I mean, one of them was Marrakesh. I mean, what was going on there? You know, like, but that gets kind of missed. Whatever was going on in Paris, New Mexico, all these, you know, we lose sight of how much there is out there that's provable. That's the thing. If we have proof that Epstein is performing satanic rituals in that temple, I'm fine with that coming out. I have no problem. But there is proof of him abusing kids daily in Palm Beach in New York on a much more benign scale. that's documentable, that we can actually get him on. So that to me is what's that I'm more concerned with that. I would rather get him on that and see him rot in prison than spend our whole lives trying to prove that he's a member of the Mossad and Illuminati and never get it.
Well, I mean, this gets to a point that I really wanted to touch on, if only briefly. And it's listen, when I first looked at the Epstein case, I just sort of intuitively knew this has legs.
Mm.
And I'm a person that is actually very, very skeptical of a lot of the sort of pedophile conspiracies that are pushed within conspiracy land. I'm even skeptical of things like the Franklin cover-up, to be honest, and Paul Bonacci's claims. But you look at this and you can tell that it has legs. And it's just interesting because it's the one case of this where I said this is not a satanic panic thing. This is not a grifter like Ted Gunderson making up nonsense. This has real legs. And the people that were always pointing it out were the people I often disagreed with on those other cases. But I just find it interesting because, you know, in a way, the people that we always call conspiracy theorists, they were right about this.
I tend to have some reservations about how the alternative media covers or the conspiracy culture covers things like, elite pedophile groups and networks. And certainly that, I think I tend to believe that the Franklin scan, that there is something there. I tend to agree that there was some kind of a network that was operating. I trust Nick Bryant, who's also worked on Epstein and saw a lot of crossover between the two.
Can I comment on that real quick? I have no issue with Nick Bryant. I want to put that out there. I actually like Nick Bryant. I think some of the stuff with the Johnny Gosch case and whatnot is very weird to me, and I'm a little bit sketchy on that stuff. But overall, Nick Bryant seems like an honest guy, and he actually revealed some stuff about Epstein early on. So I want to get that out of the way. I don't trust – I have reservations about people like John DeCamp and Ted Gunderson, but I don't want to go off into too much of a tangent about it.
I have issues with them as well, But we should also like it shouldn't be like a again, that's like a thing like you can't if you don't subscribe to whatever the conspiracy like narrative is, you're like ostracized. So, again, I get all this hate. I'm some kind of like a, Jewish plant I was getting these comments on YouTube that. I have too many friends that go to synagogue and donate shekels to my Patreon, so that's why it's easy to kind of get lost in the weeds with all this stuff. But yeah, like you said, when I saw this, I thought there's legs to this. There's something about this that rings true, and this is like another issue with the Epstein thing. That I found so interesting was like how many people this guy was connected to, like how many lives were touched by Epstein, both on the massive scale of his victims. I mean, the abuse of easily thousands of girls, that we know of probably. But then just the amount of elite, erudite people that he rubbed shoulders with. There just seemed to be there's too much to this story for it to be totally false. But it's a shame, like we've been kind of saying, that it gets kind of sucked into this kind of out there conspiracy stuff. And
I want to give an example real quick. So if you look at the McMartin preschool case, a lot of those parents dislike Ted Gunderson because they said that. They weren't talking about witches on broomsticks. And then Ted Gunderson comes in and starts talking about that. And it completely, ruins any possibility of a case.
Mm.
Because you end up looking like whack jobs when you're talking about witches flying around on broomsticks. And there were parents that were very angry about that. as I recall from my reading on McMartin, and I'm like, I don't really want that to happen with a case like Epstein. Not that I think it will, but I think people need to be very careful with the claims they make in these cases. This is a real serious issue. I mean, this is, you know, trafficking of children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. I mean, these are real people with, you know, real emotions and vested interests in this. And I think you're so spot on, JG, with this, you know, and this has always been the way the media has covered Epstein in the past, before now, and even now as well. I mean, it's maybe even more amplified. It's a, you know, we'll only cover him in so much as it makes Bill Clinton look bad, or in so much as it makes Donald Trump look bad. Not that they're both obviously as complicit in all of this. And it also, you kind of lose sight of the fact that we're talking about real victims here. You know, the Trump and Clinton and all these other people, they're complicit in this, and they might even be abusers in this. But don't, like you said, don't insert your own political agenda into a case where at the heart of it, it is about a individual by the name of Jeffrey Epstein who is abusing and destroying children's lives because he believes that he is entitled to do so. That's what's, you know, really happening here. And, you know, again, the I think that there's also there's something kind of staring so many people in the face. And I think it's hard for people to fully admit it. And I don't know, maybe this is because it's, you know, it's too whatever, liberal or whatnot. But I mean, you know, I think in part that the Epstein stuff is coming out so much now is because, and Acosta himself even admitted this, is that we live in a post Me Too. And I hate, you know, I don't know. I mean, I kind of hate the hashtagification of, like, you know, people that are sexually abused, but we do live in an environment where this is no longer, you can't get away with it as easily. Acosta said that himself in his own press conference, that, you know, would things have been different? He was like, well, yes, people are less trusting of the government. They are, you can't slut shame victims in the same way. So, you know, Epstein, I think, also operated. Again, I'm not saying that the intelligence stuff isn't there. I think it has to be on some level, because there's too many people connected to him, you know, for intelligence not to be interested. But beyond that, Epstein lived in an environment where the media, law enforcement, celebrity, you know, the elites, all these people were operating in an environment where they could get away with it. I mean, that's how Weinstein operated in Hollywood for decades. That's how Woody Allen, that's how all of, you know, any of these people that have been caught up in this whole thing. That's how, you know, Bill Clinton was able to do it for so long. I mean, just the amount of women that Bill Clinton is, at the very, you know, best case scenario, sexually harassed, worst case, sexually assaulted. I mean,
well, you know, I was going to say in that regard, it's fascinating because, like, the reason a lot of the more outlandish stuff gets out there is because the mainstream media is having to admit its failures in a lot of these regards. I mean, the way they treated Monica Lewinsky, I think, was, like, very
sure
just wrongheaded. And now I see articles where they're like, well, Juanita Broderick actually was probably credible, and, you know, we shouldn't have politicized it so much. Well, it's like you've just discredited yourself when you admit that,
mm-hmm.
you know. So the mainstream media didn't cover Epstein. They didn't cover a lot of these cases, and they've sort of created this problem for themselves now with regards to their own credibility.
Oh, totally. And I think that when you have sexual predators like Bill Clinton, Jeffrey Epstein, Donald Trump, Alan Dershowitz, and they're aware that the media is going to spin it to protect them, you don't need the Mossad to protect you. You can just get away with it by, and I think that there is people don't want to admit that. I think that particularly the more right wing you know, Epstein truthers, they believe, obviously, the Me Too movement is some sort of deep state, you know, socialist plot. to control men or whatever. So they're unwilling to admit that, you know, for most of, you know, time immemorial, men could just kind of get away with this, or at least the elites could get away with this, women included, could get away with this. They don't want to, you know, admit that, because that kind of destroys their own dynamic, you know, the war against men and feminism is evil. So they don't want to admit that. On the other end of that, I think that the liberal contingent, you know, the progressive liberal, you know, Epstein truthers, they believe basically the same thing. Bill Clinton couldn't have done that. You know, not Bill. He's a good guy. And it makes them feel better at times to imagine that Epstein is this larger than life figure connected to the, you know, global pedophile elite and intelligence, because that's easier than accepting the fact that a guy like Epstein could operate like this for years undetected. Look at the Catholic Church. I mean, nobody was willing to take them on.
I like the way that I believe it was in one of the documents or one of the attorneys said that, you know, Epstein was so obsessed with not going to prison, avoiding being in prison for long periods of time, that he basically was trying to create a gilded prison for himself. You know, like, mm-hmm. because he's part of this new gilded age, this new gilded class. And to me, that's the key to understanding this. Like we said earlier, you know, people like Epstein, there are different roles, you know, and it's happening. I think people are becoming more attuned to it because we see these, you know, gaps in economic equality. I mean, people, the gaps between the rich and the poor are getting much, much bigger.
Sure. Oh, and keep in mind also that Epstein and Maxwell, to a large degree, had been rehabilitated within the elite circles that they all ran in. This is like the other kind of strange thing, and again, it's only coming out now that it's socially acceptable to talk about this. But like the Hollywood Reporter of all publications has been writing about this, and others, that, you know, Epstein and Maxwell, they were still fixtures within New York and Hollywood elite circles. That, you know, Peggy Siegel, who's an extremely powerful PR person, maybe one of the most powerful, you know, fixtures within the PR world in New York and Hollywood. You know, you don't win an Oscar without Peggy Siegel, backing you, and she's extremely influential. Siegel is the one who was behind the infamous 2010 dinner party at Epstein's house in honor of Prince Andrew. But Siegel was like still hanging out with him. That she was still, you know, Epstein's also, he's hiring, as I said, R. Curry Hay to improve his, public image. Jeffrey Epstein attended the Gotham Awards in New York City in November in 2017. He was still giving money to Harvard. They were still taking his money. Maxwell was, at Oscar parties in 2014. Here's another crazy one. 2016, the New York premiere of Warner Brothers' Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, Peggy Siegel was introducing people to Jeffrey Epstein. You know, he was there at her, you know, she invited him. So that's 2016. You've got this guy who, at that point, I mean, he was not a household name, but everybody knew what a scumbag he was. I mean, he was there were open, you know, there were articles about him. There were lawsuits going on. Everybody knew who Epstein was. He's at a public premiere in New York City, and no journalists write about this. We only know about this now. So that, again, speaks volumes to the fact that this fucking guy didn't need Mossad to protect him, because everybody, you know, all of these journalists, nobody was writing about this. I didn't know that he was at this premiere. It's only now that we're finding out, you know, 2 or 3 years after the fact. So these people, men and women, Maxwell, you know, obviously is as complicit in all this. They were in, like you said, JG, I mean, they were the wealthy are in a stratosphere that we do not know, and they get away with a lot, and they are protected by law enforcement that looks the other way, by a justice system that doesn't really provide justice, if to the poor, and a media that is at the very best, they're writing stories that their editors are crushing, and they're afraid to go and do it publicly, or they're just not reporting on it. So, you know.
Well, yeah, I was going to say with the mainstream media, too, it's so easy for people in media to make rationalizations, too. I mean, there was a Vice article, I believe, a year or so ago that said, you know, the Jeffrey Epstein case is fueling anti-Semitic sort of right-wing, alt-right conspiracy theories, which they're right about, right? That is true. Like, there are alt-right people that are trying to use it as a battering ram. But does that mean we shouldn't cover the case?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can understand why they make the rationalization. I still think it's wrong that they rationalize it in that way, though.
Yeah. Oh, and it just while we're on, you know, right-wing media, we talked about this before. What's that right-wing Garipe?
Yes, J.F. Garipe,
yeah.
Who is also a serial abuser.
Yeah, serial abuser of, like, developmentally challenged young women. And he got money from Epstein. You know, and now, granted, when Epstein gave money to, I think it was Neuro TV, which is still...
Is that confirmed?
Absolutely.
Because I know that Garipe, he said it to, Richard Spencer, and Richard Spencer was, like, horrified, right?
Yeah.
Which was, that's the only time I could see Richard Spencer being horrified by anything, other than getting his face punched in. But I was just like, so that's real.
That is real. There is a, there is a press release on one of Epstein's, you know, Epstein had, like, 10, 11 different websites, you know, for all of his charities and things. There is a press release on one of those. You have to use, like, the Wayback Machine because all of his websites are defunct. But, there's a press release talking about the money that they donated to Neuro TV. And, yeah, and he – Garipe is – he's openly admitted it a few times now. You know, and he says –
He brags about it.
Yeah, I know. He's – just
– He says it with this, like, joy in his face. It's
yeah,
weird.
But, you know, he only said that, like, after it was reported, I believe, in the Miami Herald. Like, he didn't offer up that information until it was out in the Miami Herald, I think, or that it was being publicly discussed that he had taken the money. And he, oh, yes, you know, yeah, I took the money from Jeff Epstein, you know, who would have known, you know, the Jewish guy would, you know, give money to me, sort of making a joke about it. But it's like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, it's like when you look at Garipe's own history as an abuser and, you know, he's taking money from an abuser. I mean, I don't know. Do these people just kind of know? Like, is that a thing that they can tell from one another? There's a great, really great Sam Fuller film called The Naked Kiss, which I highly recommend to everybody. And that is The Naked Kiss is a thing that prostitutes seem to know. It's a type of kiss that a pedophile gives you. And Sam Fuller made this movie in the 1950s. And the naked kiss is the kiss that, you know when it's a pedophile because he gives you a naked kiss. And I don't know, maybe, you know, Epstein and all these other people, there's some other naked kiss that they're able to give one another. They all know. They see who it is, you know, across the table. And I don't know, maybe that's why Epstein has surrounded himself with all these abusers, Alan Dershowitz, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, Woody Allen. I mean, Jean-Luc Brunel. I mean, the list goes on. Is it all coincidence? I don't think so.
Well, you know, I think the bigger point that I want to maybe start wrapping up on is, you know, the thing that I've been finding, you know, maybe it just seems more prevalent now, but it seems like mainstream media is sort of falling apart in a lot of ways when it comes to covering stories. I mean, they're just catching up on Epstein, which people like yourself, Ed Opperman, many others in the sort of independent citizen journalist sphere were covering it. I'm seeing the stuff about Palantir and ICE coming out now. Barrett Brown was talking about that months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like the mainstream media is discrediting itself because you have independent journalists that are saying they're saying everything and predicting everything that's going to happen in the mainstream media months before at this point.
Yeah.
Years before in the case of Epstein. I mean, it's a really volatile situation.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, we should point out too, like, Ed and I were relying, you know, at the time on some mainstream outlets that were writing. I mean, but, you know,
the Miami Herald, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
no, I mean, the Herald didn't write about this at all until Julie K. Brown got involved. I mean, like I said, Jane Musgrave at the Palm Beach Post wrote about it. Vicki Ward obviously wrote about it to an extent. You also had things like Radar Online, you know, which Epstein helped fund at one point. You know, they were publishing things, including like Virginia Roberts' criminal complaint and others. But, you know, yeah, for the most part, the mainstream media was completely out of the loop when it comes to this. And I think that's like a lot of stories as well. And they are playing catch up. I don't know what that really means for like the future of media. I think it's good, you know, maybe for people like you and I. You know, we might be able to kind of like make a name for ourselves or really make it, you know, turn it into a career. I think it just, you know, I think it shows that much of the traditional media is just they haven't really caught up to trends and things like that. You know, you see this all the time. If you go to an article like the New York Post is always kind of pisses me off with this. They do cover the Epstein stuff pretty well, and they have for a while, or at least like, you know, there'd always be like one guy that would have some little, you know, short two paragraph story about Epstein being spotted somewhere. That's cool. Post will also, you know, has gotten some interesting legal documents related to this. They will talk about it, but they're never going to link to it. You know, that's something that I would say that, you know, the sort of like independent media is very up on. You're seeing it a little bit more now here and there. You will see mainstream outlets actually link to something, but that's still something they're not doing because it's like this, you know, it's sort of like, well, that's not for the, you know, the peasants aren't really allowed to see what we're doing. Whereas, you know, anyone, and I encourage people to go and do this immediately, go and create a Pacer account so you can view any court records that you want to view in any, you know, local, state, federal, whatever it is. It's easy. It's free to make a Pacer account. You know, you do have to pay quarterly for whatever you download, but it's not that much money. And you can look up, you know, I'll let this, if any of your listeners are interested, the current case right now, the docket number for the case against Epstein is 1:19-CV-00490. You type that in, you can look up everything that's on the docket sheet. There's tons of information out there. So, you know, when a media outlet is talking about it, it's not this like secretive thing that only the initiated are allowed to, you know, there's no occult knowledge here. This is out there for everybody. And I think that, you know, more and more people are kind of catching up to that. Because you will see that more now. News outlets will, you know, they'll have a link to a PDF of a court document. They used to not do that. But, you know, I think they know that, like, well, if we don't do that, we're just going to get people that are going out there and doing it themselves or getting it from people like me who put up tons of court documents related to Epstein and related to, you know, George Nader. Another one of these sickos who's, you know, he's looking at some time in prison. You can put these things up for free and people can view them as much as they want to and use them and they're all there. And yeah, I think that the traditional mainstream media is kind of catching up to this, but they're still not catching up to it fast enough.
Well, yeah, definitely. I think the stakes are getting much higher, in the sort of times we live in. Like I said, I feel like, a lot of our society's elites are just, you know, making their bank robbery, so to speak, and just not caring about anything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to hell with it and, you know, go, go, go. Like I said, someone like Epstein, it just seems like a dude that he just he didn't even make an attempt to really make any of this a secret.
Well, I like I said, I don't think he, I think he felt that he didn't have to, because right, he ran exactly in these circles where everyone around him was doing this, and he understood that, you know, prior to the Me Too stuff, you could get away with this. I mean, the Weinstein stuff was an open secret. And Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, I mean, no, it was not like a shocker that this was going on. I mean, the Bill Cosby thing, that, you know, I mean, that literally did take Hannibal Buress saying, you know, Google Bill Cosby rape. It was out there. He knew about it. He's just a comedian.
Well, I mean, even when we're talking about the Weinstein case, I remember Rose McGowan was telling people this, you know, 4 or 5 years before it broke in the news. She was blackballed from Hollywood. I'm not saying Rose McGowan has her own weird issues. Yeah. She works with like people like Victor Salva, which I can't understand how he still has a job in Hollywood. Mm. But, you know, she was talking about it. She got blackballed. And I'm like, now everyone's talking about it. I mean, a lot of this stuff is an open secret. It really is.
For sure. Absolutely. And it's there if you want. And you know, there's a fair amount of I remember, like, you know, for my own personal thing, I would obviously my parents are aware of the podcast and the radio show and the work I do. And I remember, you know, talking about the Epstein stuff back in 2015 when I was first looking into it. And it was sort of one of those things where it was like, you know, people like my parents and like their generation, you know, because I would get this with like co-workers and stuff. It was sort of like, I don't doubt it, but I don't want to believe it, so I'm not going to look into it. And now, you know, my parents are, I mean, you know, my mother was texting me when Epstein got arrested. You know, she was like, look, you know, they got your guy. Like, you know, and totally, she, you know, and she was telling me, you know, things about like, my God, I really didn't know the extent to which like Clinton and others were involved with him, you know, and why did she finally accept it? Because NPR had to talk about it. You know what I mean? So there's a fair amount of that going on as well. But it's like I said, and agreeing with you, these people were able to openly operate like this. And I think that, you know, there are people too of a certain generation where they knew that this was sort of happening. They knew, you know, they had heard the rumors about Harvey Weinstein and others out there. I mean, the whole casting couch thing, I mean, that goes all the way back to the beginning of Hollywood. That probably is like, you know, during you know, Shakespeare, Marlowe's time, the casting couch existed. I think a lot of people kind of willfully chose to pretend like it wasn't happening because it's upsetting.
Well, it's like there was just a piece in Vanity Fair that came out a few hours ago, The Horrors of Jeffrey Epstein's Private Island. And, you know, they were basically just interviewing people from St. Thomas, which is near...
near the Virgin Islands.
Little St. James. Yeah, yeah, the island. And they were like, yeah, we were seeing people... We were seeing underage girls being brought there as late as this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they didn't, you know, the locals knew. I mean, people in New York knew. People in Florida knew. It's just like, how do you talk about this? How do you confront it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and seemingly, yeah, it was I think there's an element of who's going to listen. That's certainly prevalent. And at the same time, too, I think there was kind of like a, yeah, you know, come see, come saw. That's just how it is. And you know, I mean, obviously that's like, that's how a lot of these guys in Hollywood and the media were operating. People saw it every day, but nobody did anything. That's just kind of how it is. I mean, look at them. Oh, what's it? Roger Ailes, you know, and all, Bill O'Reilly. I mean, these things were totally out there. They were operating it. I mean, I mentioned before, like, this Epstein and Maxwell at these, like, big Hollywood parties with tons of media, but nobody reports on it. There was a I think there was a story about, like, Weinstein either, like, assaulting a woman or, like, physically assaulting, like, a photographer or something at, like, a red carpet. There's not one single photo of that, even though there are hundreds, thousands of photos of every other moment, because he commanded that kind of authority. So it's like when you can do something, you can like assault someone in public and nobody knows about it. I mean, you know, you can assault people in private. Very quickly, though, JG, I know we went long and my voice is going, but I think our very first conversation that we did for Parallax Views on Epstein related to Steve Bannon and his meeting. And, he has kind of popped up again in the news. He appears to be one of the sources for Michael Wolff's book, the second Fire and Fury. I think he was a source for both of them. But I actually think now my contention is that that meeting that Epstein and Bannon had however many months ago was so that Bannon could get information about Trump and Epstein. And that's what he fed to Michael Wolff, because Michael Wolff is, as far as I know, is the first person to publicly write about this falling out that Donald Trump has hinted at between him and Epstein that revolves around a shady real estate deal where Trump went behind Epstein's back and bought property that Epstein wanted. And then it turns out that, at least according to Wolff, that, this wasn't even really Trump buying it. He was using his name as a front for some Russian that he wanted to buy this property, and that facilitated the breakup between Trump and Epstein. Interestingly, though, neither one of them has turned on one another. So God knows what they have on each other. But I think that, Bannon was trying to get information, which is kind of like, my God, I mean, Bannon really will work with anybody. And what is Bannon's, agenda with all of this?
Yeah, I kind of wonder about Bannon, with the whole no one talks about it anymore, but the porn and meth house.
Sure, sure. Or Bannon backing Moore in Alabama, and then when Ivanka gets upset about that, he basically makes a direct reference to the lawsuit by Katie Johnson alleging that Trump and Epstein raped her. So, and it's like, if Bannon...
Ed Opperman just announced, by the way, that he was involved in the Katie Doe case.
Yes.
So if anyone's interested in learning more about the Katie Doe allegations against Trump, go to Opperman Report.
Yes, highly recommend that. It's like, if Bannon is saying it, I tend to believe it, Like, he's one of those people that is clued in enough. If he doesn't know for a fact that Trump and Epstein were an item, he at least believes it. Which I think is important. Bannon is a despicable, psychotic individual, but I believe him,
Well, I just wanted to ask one more thing, and then I'll let you go, because I know we went long. A lot of people have been saying to me when I've been talking about the Epstein case with a few people over the past few weeks, and, more people that are not as clued in, that don't follow it as much, have said to me that they feel just the political economy in our country is such where, someone like Paul Manafort can get away with things, or, people that are connected will just get away with things. And they're saying, I don't think it's going to be any different with Epstein. Like, he's just going to skate again, like he always has, and like the rich and the wealthy and the powerful seem to do. What would you say to them? Do you think this time it's different?
I'm not sure. I've definitely bounced back and forth a little bit with this. Certainly Ed and I talk about this very frequently. And, Ed, I think, would say is a little bit more kind of pessimistic. He believes that, it's possible that Epstein gets away with it. I know a lot of people, myself included, I talk to, if he's going to go down and he's going to die in prison, and maybe not from old age, And Ed's whole thing was like, he said this on one of my subscriber podcasts we did recently on this, that, if you are successful outside of prison, you are successful inside of prison. And it doesn't matter if you're a pedophile or a murderer or a drug dealer. If you're successful outside, you're successful inside. Ed said there's this kind of this myth that child molesters are, being raped and tortured and killed in prison. That's not always the case. Ed made it sound like that's really, that's more rare than you would believe. And you know that if you're as successful as Epstein, you're going to be successful in prison. That's entirely possible. Ed also pointed out the fact that on the more pessimistic side, the prison system is extremely complex, and it's a very opaque organization on a grand scale. And there are definitely ways of hiding prisoners in prison and making prisoners appear to be locked up when they are not. And that is true. There are prisons more secretive than Guantanamo Bay that operate within the federal prison system in America. And that is just a fact. There are people that are arrested on terrorism charges that are ostensibly put into the federal prison system and then are disappeared to prisons that we know less about than Guantanamo Bay. To bring back 9/11, Ali Mohammed, who was some type of operative that worked for military intelligence, the CIA, and Al-Qaeda at one point in his life, was a rep.
Peter Lance, Triple Cross.
Yes.
There's a whole book about it. That's worth reading.
Yeah. Ali Mohammed is allegedly in federal prison. No one has been able to find out where in federal prison he is. There is, speculation that Ali Mohammed is a free man. Could something like that happen with Epstein? It's not inconceivable. I tend to believe I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think that Epstein will go down on some level. This particular federal indictment is not as – it seems a little more milquetoast than people might have wanted. And that might be true, and perhaps this one won't be the one that gets him. Although I think SDNY has a lot to lose if they can't get a conviction and like a real conviction. I tend to believe, SDNY doesn't take on a case unless they're pretty positive they can get him. That being said, if he gets, if they lose this case, if Epstein gets some sort of nice arrangement, I think that it's going to be death by a thousand cuts. I think for me, the floodgates are open. There are more women coming forward now that are going to be filing civil suits. And, he's not going to be able to survive this forever. It's always been my assertion that once the door was open to openly suing Epstein in a public setting and having the media put him under a microscope, that he will not survive. So that's, I think his days are numbered. I don't know if it's going to be this particular suit that's going to get him, but I don't know. I think that I think he's being squeezed. I think the people around him are feeling the pressure. Alan Dershowitz, Maxwell. I am not super confident that some of his co-conspirators are not going to flip on him. Sarah Kellen, Leslie Groff, Malyashev, Nadia Marchenkova, Adriana Ross. There's a lot of people out there I don't know if they're going to be able to stick by him. And if one of them flips, it's going to be a big thing. So,
well, their reputations are ruined at this point.
For sure. They're not. Yeah, exactly. And they don't quite have the, gravitas that Epstein does to kind of rehabilitate themselves. So, yeah, I'm optimistic that we're going to get Epstein eventually. And I feel pretty optimistic. I mean, again, this is SDNY, I mean, they have a pretty good conviction rate. There's a reason they try terrorism cases here. They almost always win. I'm optimistic about Epstein.
Yeah, and I guess in closing, I'll just say, for as much as we've talked about Epstein, I do hope that everyone remembers and thinks about the victims as well. I'll throw it to you. Any last words that you have about the Epstein saga?
Yeah, I would just to first reiterate what you just said there. To remember that there are victims here. There are or survivors. I know that the term victim can be kind of like a negative one. I tend to use it because in a legal sense, that's how they are described. So it's just it's more just, you know, for that thing. But yeah, there are real people here with real lives, with real emotions. Some of these victims are also, you know, they are not without flaws. So keep that in mind as well as more stuff becomes uncovered. These are complex individuals that there's no cookie cut. No victim is a total angel because no one is a total angel. You know, just understand that these are people that have had some really serious things happen. Don't lose sight of the fact that they're real people, that that this case is about them as much as it is about Epstein or anything else, and that none of those victims have ever seen real justice. Some of them might have gotten some financial settlements, which is not a you know, that doesn't signify something bad. You know, I know some people will make a, oh, well, they took the money. Good for them. Why shouldn't they take the money? I mean, like they've earned it, you know, for, I mean, and that's a horrible thing to have to be compensated, you know, with money for your own psychological, physical, sexual trauma. But yeah, keep in mind that these people, that there are real victims. There are more victims out there. There are people that are really suffering. There are people that Epstein has manipulated, like we were saying, people that were recruited that became recruiters. Imagine the undue influence that Epstein has to exert on someone to turn a victim into someone that will victimize other people their own age. That takes a tremendous amount of power and manipulation, and we should just be cognizant of that fact. This guy is a monster, and he, you know, really hurt a lot of people. And those people that he hurt are trying to get their justice. And we shouldn't lose sight of that because of political agendas or social agendas or whatnot. And I think also, you know, not make this about ourselves. I see a lot of people doing that. You know, Cernovich is a key, you know, culprit of this, is that, oh, they're not going after this thing, and why aren't they talking about Bill, and why aren't they talking about Trump, or they're not, who cares? You know, like, let the victims, who this is really about, let them make their own decisions. It may not be the decisions that we want, but I don't think that we can tell them that they're making the wrong choice. So just keep that in mind, keep an ear to the ground. Also, I think just be skeptical of what comes out. There's a lot of stuff out there. Don't just assume everything. You know, it's funny too. Everyone, you know, in the alternative media criticizes the mainstream media for, you know, not covering this and blah, blah, blah. You know, but they're willing to accept all of these mainstream articles that are coming out that are openly talking about Epstein being, you know, this, that, and the other thing. So now they'll accept it because it's in the New York Times. So be skeptical of what's coming out. Think critically about the Epstein stuff. And again, get a Pacer account. Read these court documents for yourself.
Well, hey, Pierce, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you, Gigi.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed this return edition after a lengthy absence. I was dealing with a lot of regrouping after my graduation and spending time with family, as well as some technical difficulties involving the breaking of my computer. I should have been using a cloud storage system. I'm still a little bit too old school. I had to retrieve a lot of files from that broken computer, but they are intact, and I will be releasing them over the coming weeks. Just bear with us as we regroup here on Parallax Views, and be sure to keep following the Jeffrey Epstein case with hosts like myself, Pierce Redmond of Porkins Policy Review, and Ed Opperman of The Opperman Report. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it. got to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing this like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.